From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I really want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Please let me take a moment here to point out that the opinions expressed on our program do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of this radio station or Interfaith Alliance. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio. In early 1933, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a young German pastor and theologian as the Nazi Party ascended to power in Germany. Just days later, he delivered a radio address that sounded a warning to the nation, and particularly to the organized church, about the grave dangers the collaboration of nationalism and religious fervor posed. His words did not go unnoticed. The broadcast was interrupted. And in the years that followed, Bonhoeffer spent time abroad before ultimately being executed by the Nazis just before the fall of the regime. The relevance I see today of the struggles and teachings of Dietrich Bonhoeffer is the lockstep way the organized religion of his time seemed unable to challenge or even resist the ever-escalating demands of the regime and its supporters. The young leader continues to be held in such high esteem that a high-profile organization exists to this day bearing his name, the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute in Washington, D.C. On this week's show, I'll pose the question of how close we are to a Bonhoeffer moment, to the Institute's president, the Reverend Rob Shank. But first, what inspires a successful businessman and attorney, secure in his place in polite society and bolstering by a growing coziness between moneyed interests and the emergent political religious right, to follow instead his conscience and align himself with a more constitutional, inclusive view of America and its values? Alex DeForger is in the rather rare position to be able to answer that question in the first person. A longtime member of the Interfaith Alliance Board, and an early champion of State of Belief Radio. As we mark the 14th anniversary of this program, I want to share a conversation that Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline and I conducted together with Alex in New York City a few weeks ago. Sharp as ever at age 96, I think Alex offers some essential insights into following one's conscience and stepping out of one's comfort zone, particularly when the stakes are as high as they have become. And so, here is a part of that conversation. Where is justice today? What do you see as the real problems for justice to attack now? Is it immigration? Is it voting rights? What is it?
Well, I think it's justice itself is under attack. I mean, when the leader of our country disparages the judicial branch and questions their integrity and their decisions and would mischaracterize a decision simply because it was given by somebody who was appointed from the other party and seeking to make the justice system a party issue, Republicans kind of justice and Democrat. I just think that is the most dangerous issue that I see on the basis of philosophy coming out of this current period. Also, whether it be the intelligence, the FBI, the Department of Justice, to say certain things are treasonous or fraudulent or shams. People who have not had a lot of contact with the Justice Department might believe that some of this is true. Yes, there are many issues in which we've got to resolve, whether it be climate or immigration or schools or infrastructure, whatever. But I think the greatest risk is to the pinnings of the democracy, which are based on laws that have been enacted in a democratic society that are applicable to all people and given without fear of reprisal and total independence. And to disparage that whole system of justice is the only thing that holds us as a democracy. Once you can get rid of the judges and those in the Justice Department, well, then it's a free-for-all. So we will still have all of the specific issues to cope with, but just undermining the value of the independence of justice is a frightening concept.
We're seeing a lot of young people, middle-aged people, some older people who are wringing their hands about what's going on in our nation. What advice would you give today to someone deeply disturbed by what they're see happening in our nation? It's happening in government, it's happening in religion, it's happening in justice issues. Tell us what you would say to encourage such a person and to make clear that even one person of goodwill taking action can make a difference.
Well, I think I would start back in the school system. Instruction with respect to some of American history to understand why we are here, how we got here, and what the hopes and dreams of our founders were, and how we have weathered problems as we have gone along with wars and assassinations and a whole roast of problems, that get a sense of what we are here for and what it's all about and what our expectations may be. Next is to stay informed, and with the modern age of communication, you know, maybe you get bits and pieces, but at least to try to stay informed on major issues that are happening in terms of our country, our government, and policy issues. Then I would say get involved. Do what you can. Volunteer, participate, have a voice in what's happening. Start in your local community. A lot of the issues are now being sent over to states and not the federal. So get involved there. And by all means, turn out to vote. Yes, your vote does make a difference. Too many of the young, I think, are turned off by what they see in the political world. But if we don't get out there and cast a ballot, things will not change.
Alex, Welton mentioned in introducing you that you maintain a relatively low public profile. But there are a few brief videos of you on the internet from the time you were at Legal Services, mostly taking on people from the very conservative right wing of politics at that point. Some of those folks that you spoke with are yet involved with the current administration. Do you have, I don't know how to put this without making it sound disparaging, do you have respect for the positions that conservatives take in regard to public services for the poor and tax dollars devoted to the uplift of people without financial resources? Or do you think they're just full of, to borrow a phrase from a political candidate, full of malarkey?
There's a question of how much government should we have when there is such a wide and ever-widening disparity between what ordinary people may have financially and what those who have been most fortunate and successful have. I mean, the gap keeps getting larger. And together with that, when there is a desire to have less government, I think that certainly is a conservative point of view. We don't want as many restrictions and regulations, and we don't want government doing many things. That leaves it up to private philanthropy to fund things that I think might otherwise be government activity. For example, major museums should be available to the public generally. Some now are charging admission. They are dependent upon the generosity of their board members. And their board members, not only in museums but in other institutions, with their wealth, can determine the operation and nature and functioning of these institutions that used to be public institutions. So it depends. If you're into minerals, you know, you can do things that affect climate change. There are those who are now complaining that some members of these boards who are there by reason of their philanthropic giving maybe are engaged in antisocial kind of activity, which gets to the issue of freedom of speech and the like. But there is whether you do a wealth tax or you increase income tax or you have government play a bigger role, I think while it is fine to have private philanthropy and urge people to support charity, including those in poverty as distinct from the arts and the ballet and the educational institution, it's important that there be the opportunity, at least the government, to step up and provide that funding if the philanthropic world is not that engaged. Now, some are already supporting it, you know, there's no doubt. But for the legal services to those who cannot afford, the federal government is now funding the Legal Services Corporation in the range of $400 to $500 million. 40 years ago, the government was giving $300 million. So there has been a loss of support for this program, and there's no way that that program could conceivably serve all the needs of those seeking access to justice. Hmm. So there is still support from corporations and legal organizations, but it is not something that rings as important in the minds of people thinking of their own charitable philanthropy. It's more likely to be hospitals or institutions of the arts or the like.
You're hearing part of a conversation Jack Moline and I conducted with longtime interfaith activist Alex Forger. Alex, you've been around and worked with scores of prominent political families and politicians. All three of us have now experienced impeachment more times than anyone ought to have to experience in a lifetime. If you could, what would be the major changes that you would make to politics in America in 2020?
Well, that's a rather large assignment. I, having experienced 3 years with our Congress, I may be quite jaundiced by it all. I think the worst was when one congressman wrote me a very nasty letter about how bad the work of one of our entities had been in dealing with an agricultural client, that I showed up after investigating it, speaking to him, and he said, yeah, he understands that, and he'd still support us. But you have to realize this was one of his major contributors. And so what else was he to do? You know, I mean, vote his conscience or what he thought was right? So money in politics is a difficult issue to deal with. Terms, endless terms, is another issue. If I had a magic wand, I guess I would suggest perhaps fixed terms for members of Congress. It's sort of a clumsy way of dealing with the issues of reelection because you lose some of the experience and wisdom. But if there isn't the constant need to go raise money and satisfy the desires of a major contributor, that would be helpful. I think another thing I would do is look towards public financing to the extent one needs basically to tell the world who he or she is and why they're running. Another thing, I guess, would be the voting. So many of the states are now engaged in putting obstacles in to improving the numbers of people who can access the polls, closing down some polling places, not having early voting hours. And they're gerrymandering on top of that to try to assure one party stays in versus another. But voting ought to be a national holiday. It ought to be a day in which everybody can go out and vote, not lose a job or lose hours of work, or absentee balloting. Also have paper backups on these machines so as to avoid the claim of fraud, voter fraud, and make registration a lot simpler. So there is much that could be done to improve the electorate and also to make it possible for our elected officials to function on the basis of what's good in the policy and what's good for the country rather than what's good for me to be reelected. I look at the Senate today in the impeachment issue. It just strikes me as being strange that 50-some-odd senators would all be in agreement that there is no reason to have a vote other than oppose the vote. This president has such power over the political future of the people that it's very difficult for folks to exercise judgment in the prospect of loss of their seat in Congress.
Alex is correct that the preamble to the Constitution makes the point that establishing a more perfect union begins with establishing justice. But the Bill of Rights, which is, for lack of a better term, the human-focused aspects of the Constitution, begins with our first freedoms, which are the freedom of conscience and the freedom of government from religion and religion from government. And so there really isn't anything more critical that a citizen of this country can be concerned with than maintaining not only his or her own freedom of conscience, but that of everyone else around them, and access to and the integrity of the justice system, as Alex has devoted his life to. That's how I would frame these issues for us today.
Well, certainly there has been more movement on the religious front, prompted in large measure by certain denominations, to normalize governmental activity or support, financial support, even though it is supportive in some measure of their religious activity. I think that is a dangerous issue where there is a lessening of the distinction and the separation between the two. If one looks at abortion, for example, I guess, or woman's health, some religions may conclude that life begins at the moment of conception nowadays, that abortion would become a crime for those who participate in it, whether it be the doctor or the woman. The desire to have the distinction between private and government and the right of an individual to be free of the imposition of someone else's own view of religion becomes ever more critical. It's now into issues that relate to sexual orientation, transgender issues. It's not only birthday cakes and the like, but it's employment rules and regulations. The notion that preachers could, during their worship service, direct parishioners how to vote and where to vote and help them vote for the right party is a dangerous consequence, I believe. That should remain free for those who are converts to that. And those of us who do not believe in that denomination or indeed any religion should not be supportive of the views of others that are at odds with your own view. So that's a matter of liberty and freedom.
Alex, you have made contributions to all kinds of institutions and to people. Let me tell you, one of the great contributions you made to Interfaith Alliance while I was president remains in place. You were largely responsible for making it possible for us to launch the weekly radio program that we call State of Belief. I think of you regularly as the theme song begins to play, and I give thanks for your efforts and support that allow us to continue the broadcast. And I wish you would have heard over the years just a sampling of the feedback that I get to hear all the time from listeners who value hearing civil conversations about the importance of religion in our pluralistic secular nation. I can't thank you enough. I know Jack will want to say a word as we go off.
I consider it a great privilege, Alex, to call you my friend, and feel sorry for all the people who don't have that opportunity.
Well, I say thank you to Interfaith Alliance. In my time of struggle and concern, in my Washington days, I found an island of support, giving me my full sense of the value of spiritual life, and to see people of differing backgrounds finding common ground.
We're both delighted to have had this opportunity to introduce some of the listeners of this story to you. This will play on our radio show, and people will learn what we have learned from you and have the opportunity to take into their minds and think about what we do. It was generous of you to take this time with us. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Welton and Jack, and it's been my privilege to know both of you and to benefit immensely from that experience.
Alex Forger is a deeply private man, and it was not easy to convince him to sit down at our microphone. Still, I am certain that hearing the thoughts of someone who was willing to step so far out of his long-established comfort zone to challenge the ideas and norms shared by the pretty much everyone in his personal and professional circles can be invaluable, especially at a time such as this. My great thanks to Alex D. Forger for agreeing to this conversation and to Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline for co-hosting it with me. Up next, the Reverend Rob Shank, longtime president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute in Washington, D.C. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. It's a trap. Mention pretty much anything having to do with Nazi Germany when talking about modern times, and everybody tunes out. Most people still agree that it was an era of horrors, and most readily condemn the passivity of so many at the time in the face of escalating consolidation of power and eventual genocide. I don't want you to tune out. But at the same time, the saying is, those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. And for me, the refusal of vast swaths of the general public to acknowledge and respond to outrages being done in all of their names is the essential lesson to focus on today, not the specifics of those outrages. Now, with that in mind, I am grateful to welcome the Reverend Rob Shank, president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute, back to State of Belief Radio. Rob, thanks for being with us again.
These are very serious times, and I appreciate very much the fact that you take on these very difficult and challenging questions. So very pleased to be with you again.
Briefly summarize who Dietrich Bonhoeffer was and why the Institute bears his name.
Well, we're talking about a very brave and brilliant young Lutheran pastor in 1930s Germany during the rise of National Socialism, the Nazi Party, and Adolf Hitler. He was one of the first religious voices to speak out in resistance against first the Führerprinzip, or the idea of an omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent earthly leader for a country. And in fact, he said, when such a leader arises and is more interested in promulgating his own power and influence for his own purposes, that he becomes a misleader. So that's when he first appeared on the radar screen of the Nazi Party, which then hunted him for the rest of his short life, imprisoned him for his voice of dissent and his actions. And he was very much both a theorist, a kind of philosopher, as well as an activist leader in that time in the resistance movement against Nazism. His overall concern was the co-optation of religion, particularly Christianity and the church in Germany, by political forces, and its abuse by those political forces, and finally, its subservience to the political powers, placing the Christian message, the gospel, if you will, at the service of the political powers of the time, including Adolf Hitler himself. That's what Bonhoeffer was really struggling against, and wanted to preserve the integrity of the church and its role as a conscience for the society. He would lose that battle when he was hanged in April of 1945, but he left us a magnificent legacy, a library of work on morality, ethics, the engagement of the church with the state, and a prophetic call for us to act in the face of injustice. And so our institute seeks to form ethically courageous young leaders for our own time that reflect the kind of moral courage that Bonhoeffer exhibited in his time.
Is the activism of Bonhoeffer in your institution as well?
Very much so. In fact, that's our emphasis. There are some very good bodies of Bonhoeffer scholars, including the International Bonhoeffer Society, which we rely on to inform us. But we then take that theoretical material that's so powerful, and we apply it in very practical ways in training, shaping, and forming fully engaged leaders for our time and for our future. So we're kind of the activist side of the Bonhoeffer world.
Rob, again, I want to emphasize to our listeners that we are not drawing parallels between 1930s Germany and modern day America. What we are doing, what we must do, is looking at some of the elements of human nature that seem to play a role at key moments in our history. Or is there a different way you would phrase this core idea?
Well, I think you're right in the sense that there are patterns of human behavior on the individual level as well as on the grandest scales, the behavior of nations, for example, of whole peoples, people groups. And history does often repeat itself, both in the negative and positive senses. I think right now, we are seeing history repeat itself in one sense, and that is when people feel desperate, they often reach for short-term, temporal, maybe even in our time, instant solutions to a problem or what they perceive to be that. I think we're seeing that in the United States. We're probably seeing that in a number of European countries, maybe elsewhere on the globe. It has certainly been happening all along, but it's happening on a greater scale now, I think, maybe more quickly. And that's probably aided by technology and social media and so forth. And we can take lessons learned from Bonhoeffer's experience in 1930s Germany and extrapolate from them and apply them to our own time in our own unique way. You're exactly right that this isn't 1930s Germany. And Bonhoeffer warns over and over again in his writings that what he experienced is non-repeatable. There will never be another Adolf Hitler. There will never be another Nazi party. There will be never be another 1933, 39, or 45, Germany, Europe, the United States. We are now living in a unique time, our own time, and we have to face the challenges in unique ways. But that doesn't mean we can't glean wisdom and insight from someone who treated the great questions of ethical and moral responsibility to a social phenomenon. We can learn from that, and we can shape our own responses uniquely to our own day. And I think that's the challenge that's in front of us right now.
I've already used a Bonhoeffer moment, but now I'd like to ask you for a definition of what does a Bonhoeffer moment mean?
Well, we can begin by looking at what he referred to using a Latin term, status confessionis. In other words, a time to speak, to say what we believe, to speak out, to be heard. And this is very important because what happened in Germany, most people think that the majority of Germans in that period supported Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. They did not. There is solid research data that proves that the majority of Germans did not support Adolf Hitler or the Nazi Party, but they remained silent and inactive as Hitler and Nazism increased in first in popularity, then in influence, then in power. And they kind of sat it out. Many of them wrote about it in private journals. We have that material. And when you read it, some of the most thoughtful observers in Germany at that time would say things like Hitler is an aberration. He's a momentary phenomenon. His popularity will pass. He's an incapable, ignorant failure, and the people will soon see this and they will reject him. That never happened. That did not happen. And Hitler continued to consolidate his power. He remained, for the most part, unchallenged. Only a very small minority of people spoke out, and they were punished and vanquished quickly. So this is one of the very, very important lessons of Bonhoeffer's period. And that is that we must speak at the first indication of trouble and speak clearly, loudly, and often. And this is what he called status confessionis. It's time to speak, to say what we believe unequivocally, without apology, and to challenge this kind of corruption with our voices, perhaps with our bodies. And that gets us to another stage where eventually Bonhoeffer said, it's not enough to simply speak. One must also act. And he used the analogy of a car careening out of control and threatening the lives of pedestrians. And he said, at some point, someone must grab the wheel and stick a rod or a spoke, he called it, into it and stop the car that's careening out of control and threatening all these lives. There has to be responsible, concrete intervention. And he would take that kind of action. It was too little, too late. And that's why he warned that people of conscience must act early and not wait until their words and actions no longer matter. So those are kind of the three critical elements that I think face us in our own day.
Bonhoeffer was very disturbed by what organized religion was doing in a nation that was facing such crisis. So I want you to talk about what role he did in addressing organized religion as things got darker and darker in the 1930s of Europe.
Sure. Well, the first thing he did was he fell in with a very small number of church leaders in forming what was called the Pastors' Emergency League, which was the first assembly of local and denominational leaders who spoke first in respectful critique of the political machinations of Hitler and his Nazi party. Then came his participation in the drafting of an instrument called the Barman Declaration, which clearly set the parameters of responsibility for the religious communities vis-a-vis the state and where the boundaries for each existed. And they identified areas where the state was encroaching upon the church, was acting in ways that interfered with the spheres that the church is responsible for example, speaking into the moral, ethical responsibilities of a society, for example, and that the state was abusing its powers and overreaching its authority. That came in the Barman Declaration. And then came his work in the actual confessing church, which became an illegal entity within Germany. It was criminalized by the Nazi government. And what was happening there was the formal denominations, interestingly enough, the name of the largest body of Christians in Germany at that time was the Evangelische Kirche, the Evangelical Church of Germany. And the Evangelical Church was organizing in a way that placed it at the service of the Nazi party. In other words, gave it the religious cover, endorsement, networking, channels of communication, the appearance of moral authority that the Nazi party needed in order to continue its corrupt purposes and eventually its dictatorial and tyrannical mass murderous behavior. And it needed the church to assist it in doing that. And the formal church leadership complied either with their silence or in an active way. And Bonhoeffer helped form a dissenting body that would eventually be persecuted, punished in very, very cruel ways, including having its pastors placed on the front lines of battle. Essentially, it was a way of executing them. So that was all going on, and it was all part of Bonhoeffer's response. The most controversial part of Bonhoeffer's story is that he would join the conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler. And this is a really delicate part of the story because, first of all, he said this kind of action was never repeatable. It was unique to that moment of time and in only that place. And it was, he used again another Latin term, in extremis. He said, when all ethical and moral norms have been suspended, so is the ethical and moral nature of our response to it. For example, you kill in war, but you don't kill in any other setting. It's not normal. Or you kill when it's your only means of survival, and that should always be done with great lamentation and regret. And with agony and pain. And that's how he treated his role in the conspiracy to take out Adolf Hitler and end his terrible reign of murder and oppression. So he said this is not repeatable. But in the end, he called this responsible action, and that the responsible human being is always free in their conscience to act in a way they think they must for that moment in time, and in the end throw themselves on the grace of God and do what penance they must. And he treated it that way. He did not see this as to be celebrated, but something that actually risked his own eternal salvation. So it's a really complicated story. You have to read his magnum opus, Ethics, to really understand it. And you have to read between the lines. It's a very complicated decision. Hopefully, prayerfully, and Bonhoeffer reflected this, a society never has to get to that place. It did in 1945 Europe. We hope and pray it never will again at any other time in any other place.
Reverend Schenck, you know that all of us who have read Bonhoeffer and those of us who have studied his writings know that you can't deal with what he wrote and what he did without being a little bit nervous, shaking a little bit as to what we ought to be doing. What did we learn in Bonhoeffer that we need to be implementing now as people who are committed to a church, whatever the church is, and to try to be the kind of people that would be in a church? What did we learn?
Bonhoeffer was very clear on the fact that it wasn't simply the church that needed to speak and act responsibly and ethically when up and against immoral powers, but all people of conscience, inside and outside the church. He said we share that responsibility equally, that a moral and ethical response is the same, whether it comes from a secular or a sacred viewpoint. So I'll say that to begin with, but certainly the church. If anybody, that is any entity, any community, is responsible to speak to the injustices, the immorality, the unethical behavior of the state and of the individuals who lead it, it is the church. And he warned again that we must speak early, not late. There comes a time when words and actions no longer matter because the immoral, unethical, and injurious powers of the state become so overwhelming that words are no longer heard, no longer matter, actions are no longer effective. And this is what happened in Germany. So he warned, we must speak at the first sign, not late in the game, but very early in the game. And that's why I've been saying this is a time now for us to speak. And it's interesting, as I was preparing for this conversation with you, well, I was surprised to get a statement from the International Bonhoeffer Society, which has been very reluctant over the decades to weigh in on anything that appears to be political. But they just released a very powerful document, an instrument called a Statement of Concern. And with your permission, I'd like to read just a short paragraph in it. These scholars, most of whom are in the United States, but also are present around the world. Again, these are theologians, philosophers, ethicists, most of them professors in academies in various places. They are not politically motivated. I couldn't even tell you what parties they belong to. They behave very differently. They write very differently. But this is what they write in one paragraph of this rather lengthy document. As Bonhoeffer scholars, religious leaders, and confessing Christians, we have a special responsibility to name crises and discern responsible actions of resistance and healing. We confess our own complicity in the social order that has produced Donald Trump's presidency for many of the social and economic injustices we confront predate it. As we take responsibility for these injustices, we resist the policy goals of this administration that have contributed to ever-deepening divisions and growing vulnerability among the marginalized sectors of our population, including the dehumanizing treatment of migrants, systematic attempts to strip rights from LGBTQ persons, the increased rapacious destruction of the environment, the marginalization and assault on communities of color, especially through voter suppression, and the economic policies that have contributed to the largest disparity of wealth in the nation's history. We believe that an honest reckoning with these realities must lead to dismantling the dehumanizing ideologies and systemic inequities in which they are rooted. We believe that one crucial step in this reckoning is ending Donald Trump's presidency. We have never heard something like this come from this body of scholars before in the existence of the society. It's very significant, but it's also quintessentially Bonhoeffer. This is exactly the kind of thing that Bonhoeffer was speaking to. He said, whenever we make a statement like this, we have to be open to the idea that we might be wrong, but that doesn't excuse us from acting responsibly. As much as we know, as much as we can know, we do the best that we can with the information that we have. And that's what this body of scholars has done. So it's really, you asked about a Bonhoeffer moment. This is literally a Bonhoeffer moment when the trustees, these are the trustees of the Bonhoeffer legacy in the world. They are the proprietors of the Bonhoeffer Library of Materials. They translated all of his works, all 10,000 pages of his work into English. These are the authorities. There are none that match when it comes to interpreting Bonhoeffer and his times. And they have spoken to our time in a very concrete way. This is quintessentially the Bonhoeffer moment.
The Reverend Rob Shank is the president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute in Washington, D.C., a longtime leader in the anti-abortion movement. Rob has disavowed his high-ranking position in the American culture wars in favor of a more conscience and faith-driven approach to all of creation. He tells his moving story in a previous State of Belief interview, as well as in a powerful book titled Costly Grace, An Evangelical Minister's Rediscovery of Faith, hope, and love. Rob, as a part of your leadership at the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute, you provide people with a podcast. Would you just quickly tell us how listeners could get your podcast?
You can find it all at tdbi.org, stands for the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute, tdbi.org. Easy enough.
Rob, as we stand at the threshold of a brand new decade, this thing really could go either way. This is a conversation that I've wanted to have for quite a while now. Let's keep talking.
Amen.
Amen. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, you're helping put this show on the air. So let me say how important that is and how thankful we are for your gift. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. You can do it on social media. You can do it as you get someone in the car with you. You can do it in person on the telephone. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week. There will be more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.